Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. Your co-host Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California. Bob is out today, but will be back soon. But we're having a State of the Resistance conversation. And joining me for that is our old friend and comrade, Patrick Young. Patrick, welcome back to the Green and Red podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here. We need to get a State of the Resistance custom theme song.
Oh, yeah. We totally need to figure that out. We can do that. We can get a State of the Resistance hat. Although I wore my wobbly Sabo cat, you know, Direct Action Gets the Goods hat today. And for folks who don't know Patrick, who haven't listened to our other episodes with Patrick, Patrick is a labor organizer, climate organizer. He's worked with a number of labor unions. He's worked in Rising Tide North America and with Shutdown DC, and most recently the Movement Infrastructure Project. Patrick is a good troublemaker. And so as we're in this moment, here we are in August of 2025. We've got about six and a half, seven months in on the Trump administration. And we haven't talked, I think, maybe since May. You know, there's a lot that's happened over the summer. And maybe just to kind of kick it off, the sort of one of the big news items in the last week or so has been the Texas Democrats. This week, 50 Texas Democrats fled the state of Texas to prevent a quorum from being formed in the legislature, to prevent an aggressive redistricting plan being put together by Governor Greg Abbott, John Cornyn, in an attempt to suck up to Trump and prove how MAGA he is, because he has a difficult primary election coming up. It's called in the FBI. You know, there's a lot of authoritarian moves being made in Texas. There's a lot of authoritarian rhetoric being put out by Trump and others. I'd like to sort of get, you know, this harkens me back to what we saw in the first Trump term, which I used to call hashtag resistance, which was the Democrats, right? You know, actually doing these performative acts like Pelosi ripping up the speech in Trump's face during, I think it was a State of the Union. But when the Democrats are doing things like this, they've fled to Illinois. The governor of Illinois is sheltering them. Do you see these as legitimate acts of resistance, or is this more of the same performative politics? There's a lot more coming out with this redistricting civil war, as the media is starting to call it.
Yeah, I don't think that it's particular that what they're doing is going to be particularly effective. I wouldn't go as far as calling it completely performative. You know, the concept that hey, we're gonna leave the state, we're gonna bust a quorum, and we're gonna hold this off from happening. That's solid. That makes a lot of sense. This isn't the first time they've done it, though. Texas Democrats have done it a handful of other times, and inevitably they don't really have an exit strategy other than come back. At which point the bill is going to move, and you know, Abbott's not a complete idiot. He was able to pack relief aid for the floods into the same special session, so he's able to kind of put them in a position where they're out, they're holding off this redistricting, but they're also holding off something that folks in Texas need immediate relief on. So they know it's not going to work, because you hear the way that they're talking about it, like in their interviews. They're thinking of this as a messaging move, and frankly, I prefer them do a messaging move rather than nothing. But that doesn't mean that they've got the Democrats here have a winning strategy. They are, as you alluded, teeing up some other possibilities in the strategy. Ones that I actually don't think are really good ideas. And that is, you know, this idea that, okay, now Gavin Newsom, who anywhere there's a national news story, is going to figure out a way to insert himself. He's talking
about... Almost like he's running for president, you would think.
You know, you think he's going to run for president? It just never occurred to me that that was a possibility.
You know, that's what they say here in California, but who knows? I live an hour away from Sacramento, so... My ear's more to the
Yeah.
ground, near closer to the ground, I guess, than you at this
Yeah.
point.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, he's been running since last election. And I was surprised that he didn't jump in front of Kamala. But you know, so he's talking about doing a, you know, gerrymandering scheme in California, and it sparks this debate within the Democratic Party about like, okay, well, we say that gerrymandering is a bad thing, so why are we going to do it as well? Now, what they always say, you know, what they're saying on, you know, on the news all the time is both sides do gerrymandering, both sides do gerrymandering, and that is absolutely the case. But if you look at the maps, you look at the most egregious maps. You know, for the past 30 years, it has really been overwhelmingly we've seen gerrymandering in the most egregious cases benefiting Republicans. So it really is a more Republican phenomenon. This idea that politicians are able to pick their voters, it's a bad idea, and I don't see that as a real movement building strategy.
I mean, it seems like it's just this escalation, which what's it gonna lead to? Particularly as we see this ramping up of authoritarianism, right? It's like, you know, Texas in 2019 had a blue surge, almost elected Beto O'Rourke as to the Senate. It actually put a lot of Democrats into the state legislature and the state Senate. It's called the Beto Wave. And ever since then, the Texas Republican Party has been waging war on voting rights. I mean, there's where they're doing this redistricting because they know they're probably going to lose the House because Trump is so unpopular. Contrary to what he says in the media, he is so unpopular. And there's probably going to be an anti-Trump wave in 2026. And so they're trying to sort of head that off. But, like, you know, Greg Abbott has been waging war on the blue counties, like which are huge metropolitan areas of Texas, for since 2018. And you know, it's just it's a race to the bottom, I would actually call it.
Well, it's race to the bottom everywhere because, you know, so if Newsom is able to do it in California,
Hochul's talking about it too.
yeah, Hochul's talking about it. I think there's too many constitutional hurdles in the New York State Constitution to really move it there. But you've got Florida is talking about doing it as well. We've got J.D. Vance just yesterday in Indiana trying to build up some steam about redistricting there. There are in this strategy, in this moment, there are more, way more congressional districts for Republicans to pick up. Going down, you know, if we really nationalize this nonsense, than Democrats. And once again, it's a bad fight because it's about letting politicians pick their constituents. Not the other way around. So, it'd be one thing if the Democrats had a plan to, you know, actually win and gain more seats because of this. But I think that they're picking a battle that is politically losing, and tactically losing.
Just to sort of move on from this into the other realm, I mean, one thing that occurs to me is that a lot of the institutions which are like opposed to Trump, he's been really going after, like, you know, the universities, Columbia and Harvard, the big law firms, the white shoe law firms in New York. You know, he's really going after his, like, who he sees as his, I mean, the Democratic Party in many ways. And you know, that they just subpoenaed Bill and Hillary for the Epstein files, which we can talk about. But you know, it seems like, so I feel like the hashtag resistance is not what it was in 2017 and 2018, but the grassroots resistance, like real resistance, we're seeing all over the country. And you know, this is a big umbrella, like, and this is everything from like mass protests, which are hands off, no kings, good trouble. You know, there's more coming. I think there's going to be a big march in New York in September. And then also the community resistance we see in places like Los Angeles and Chicago against ICE and things like that. What is your view on that? It's like this grassroots resistance seems somewhat fierce. There's also lots of corporate campaigns targeting the sort of companies like te Tesla's the most obvious example. But as we see the waning of the hashtag resistance and the bending the knee to Trump, but we're seeing fiercer action in the street. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. And like I said, I definitely put this move by the Texas Democrats in the hashtag resistance category versus like what we see in Los Angeles. And we've done a couple of shows on Los Angeles too in the last couple of months.
Well, I think that we definitely I unfortunately think that we are turning a bit of a corner and moving into a new phase with the grassroots resistance. I'm going to separate that from the community-based non-compliance and the anti-ICE work. But so we saw the president's day mobilization that surprised everybody that people came out with the 50-51. Nobody ever heard of this before. They were organizing on Reddit. Then we see hands off mass mobilizations, in many cities all over the country and in smaller areas, rural areas, and historically red areas. That was a big story. Then we have the No Kings mobilization. That is timed against the Trump's birthday parade here in Washington, D.C. Once again, mass mobilizations all over the country. In fact, it may have been one of the largest single day mobilizations in U.S. history. So this is some so we saw this grow. From nobody really expecting anything to happen to what may have been the largest single mobilization in U.S. history. And then the next big day of action was the John Lewis Good Trouble mobilizations on the 17th of last month. And there were a lot of them. The map had 2,400 protests. So it's happening in a similar number of places, but in almost every case, they were just a fraction of the size of the mobilization that had happened before. So I think that this is part of what we see every time, in every one of these movement moments. Folks are like, oh, well, it's really easy to organize. All we do is we put out an announcement and we tell some people to come, and then
Bring their
some
own signs.
resources.
Bring their own signs.
Yeah, bring your own signs. Resources show up from somewhere, and it's great. And we're okay. Well, we should call for another one, and we can call for another one. And at some point, you can't just put out an announcement for a mobilization. You need a compelling moment. You need real organization. You need. Real structure to be able to deliver. And hopefully, I think that we're at that realization point for that wave of mobilization. What I'm kind of excited about is a bit of a pivot where people are certainly thinking about continued mass mobilizations. We're going to see activity on Labor Day. We're going to see some stuff happen in September. It's going to continue to go on. But we're seeing, I think two folks leading into two different projects right now. One is this set of non-compliance trainings that the co you know in general the coalition that has been It, you know, was doing the No Kings type mobilizations. They've really leaned into it, particularly Indivisible, thinking about, okay, what does it mean to move from protest to actual active non-compliance, and this arc of trainings and house parties, and that is really building on an area of work that Daniel Hunter and Nadine Block and all sorts of other really smart people in the Freedom Trainers network have been working on. Since before the beginning of the Trump term. The other thing that we're gonna, I think, see over the next four, the other big story I think we're gonna see over the next 4 weeks in terms of that type of grassroots resistance is activity At certainly the town hall meetings of members of Congress, they're on recess for a month, so they're out in the districts. So I think we're going to see, the Trump's big bad bill passed. People are understanding what is in it. They don't like it. So I think we're going to see some significant confrontations happening out in the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important thing to note is the big beautiful bill is, it's stripping away a lot of people's health care and it's stripping away a lot of stuff. And I personally think, at least on the Republican side, probably on the Democratic side too, is that they're just going to be canceling their town hall meetings, so they're not having to deal with that. But and we're already starting to see. I mean, I've been seeing on social media some of those confrontations. To kind of get into the sort of non-cooperation, non-compliance, strategy that's beginning to become elevated. I heard Daniel Hunter on a different podcast the other day talking about this, but he actually did. They actually did this training for 130,000 people on a Zoom call, which is like massive. And I mean, what do we think this is going to result in? Because I do agree that even at a certain level, I think mass protests are good. I think it's what keeps the energy up. It's a gateway for lots of people, but it also becomes like a formulaic thing that the state basically bakes into their, what they're doing. They've done it for, decades at this point. But do you think this mass non-compliance is going to begin to do? And I was actually looking at an article where Sarah Nelson in March, I think we've talked about this on a previous episode, was talking about how we need to all band together and work on a general strike. Is this going to feed into the calls for a general strike in 2028? I
Well,
personally think it should happen sooner too, by the way.
I mean, that's if we don't do something between now and 2028, the landscape is going to look a whole lot different than when we get there. So I think that the thinking about ourselves as a resistance movement fighting against democratic backsliding is the absolute right thing to
Little
do.
D Democratic backsliding.
Correct. Yes. The big D's are backsliding too,
Or part of the
or are part of it. I think that I think we're going to need some examples of people really effectively operationalizing non-compliance to really open people's imaginations just concretely, like, how do you put this, how do we not think about, okay, well, what if we like knock down this pillar, like in our role in this pillar, but like actually see, seeing activity like flight attendants saying, oh, well, air traffic control is shit right now, so we don't feel safe getting on planes, we're not going to fly. And like people putting together, oh shit, that kind of shut down the a chunk of the economy for a bit. So it is right now we haven't figured out how to put it in into practice. There's I think that there's a narrative out there that there's some army of federal workers that are doing that are doing this type of work behind the scenes. I'm not seeing it. I'm sure that some people are doing heroic things, but like we're gonna need to get some concrete examples for people to really start to understand what this means in their lives. And I don't know that we're there yet. Something that is positive about this, that 130,000 person Zoom call is that went into after that, there was another Zoom call that was like a train the trainers for having house parties to talk about this with your like people. And then over the next couple of weeks, they're having just some number of all these house parties. Where it's actually kind of a popularized like out training program that it's too early to really understand what the metrics look like, because they're being relatively smart. These events are, they're getting registered and vetted, but they're not, there's not like a website for that for them the way there was for like No Kings, where you can look at a map and see all these different, all the dots. So if that's happening at scale, if people are talking in their living rooms about, okay, what does non-compliance mean for us, then that could be a real thing that could become very, very powerful.
Yeah, and the just to kind of like pull in the Tesla takedown movement, which kind of in many ways went viral and was very much, I would say, very partnered with these mass protests. But what those protested, and in some places, at least in the places where you would expect, like New York or San Francisco, you saw people doing civil disobedience inside Tesla showrooms, or people protesting at the homes of people connected to the company. But it did bring down the stock price like by 70%, which it's an inflated thing anyway. But it's interesting that that actually had such an impact, to the point where that was one of the contributing factors to why Musk left the government and has had his split with Trump. But to see this at even, and I feel like that was at a scale that I hadn't really expected. But to see this other non-compliance and the machinations of the state is going to be very interesting. I think the whistleblowers that we've been seeing are very interesting. I think there's been like a couple of ex-ICE whistleblowers, and then Anthony Aguilar, who was ex-military, who was at the Gaza Humanitarian Project, who's been very much on the talk show podcast circuit, being a whistleblower about what they're doing in Gaza, is also, very interesting. Hopefully encourages other people to do things like that, which I think whistleblowing, to me, whistleblowing is a form of non-compliance.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up the Tesla takedown, because when I was first on the podcast, we talked about this, and I was very dismissive about the Tesla takedown. I said, hey, this doesn't make any sense. The people who are out there, they're not buying Teslas to begin with. Hell, I've been boycotting Tesla for my entire life. And I think that in what the people who were working on doing that organizing understood is that to run an effective boycott of Tesla, you can't just say, hey, nobody go buy your Tesla. What you need to do is, have people with Teslas getting stickers put on their cars talking about what kind of assholes they are. And you need to have activity at Tesla stations, and you really need to you're not just thinking about convincing people who might buy Tesla. You're creating an environment where it's uncomfortable to buy and own a Tesla, and that's the lesson there. The thing that makes me a little nervous is people talking about running boycotts of everything else now. Well, the Tesla boycott worked, so let's boycott Target. Oh, and Walmart and
Home
Palantir.
Depot, Home
And
Depot.
Home Depot, and at some point we're just picketing capitalism, right? So, in yeah, making more responsible choices about our consumption is a good thing to do, but that is different than organized non-compliance.
Just because I'm trying to keep an eye on time a little bit. The other, just to kind of like, I think this non-compliance, non-cooperation thing is going to be a theme of what we see sort of coming more and more in coming days. But you're based in Washington, D.C. There's potentially an opportunity for like mass non-compliance there, as Trump has been threatening to take over and federal, well, it's already federal, but take over like the Washington city government and the D.C. police and things like that. How are people in D.C. reacting to this? Is there organizing going on around this? Will we see non-compliance?
Absolutely. So th there is a really incredible organization in DC called Free DC, that has been doing they've been doing onboarding training, they've been doing non-compliance trainings. They are organized in a ward-based structure. They're onboarding about 1,500 people a week. It is just it's It's massive. The folks who are involved in organizing it are really, really smart. I've got tons of respect for them. They're doing some incredible work. So, and they are leaning, I think that the number one like crisis moment that they will, that they're naming is some sort of federalization of either law enforcement or the in DC or our home rule, our ability to make, some laws as long as Congress says that they're okay. So they've been doing a lot of, a lot of building. They've been involved in a lot of action, but they were like, listen, we're not gonna like really lean into disruptive action like until we're specifically fighting against this red line for us. So I'm very eager to see how that transpires. And they're doing smart stuff. Like, they're onboarding like 1,500 people a week. That they have 2% of DC's population already signed up on their on their email list. They started 6 months ago. So I think that there's a lot of really, really exciting opportunities there.
Because often Trump's threat is anywhere he's having, problems. Like he talked about this with Los Angeles about, federalizing, take the federal government taking over the city of Los Angeles and the LAPD. He actually did send the military into Los Angeles. But DC is a place where that threat is even more real because technically it is more under the control of the federal government.
And I mean, we have 47 different arresting agencies, most of which are federal in one way or another, that are already here during the and after this, after last week, this former DOGE staffer, the Big Balls or Blue Balls kid, got a well-deserved beat down by a couple of 15-year-olds. Trump announced that he's is bringing a surge of law enforcement into DC for a 7-day period. That 7-day period started at midnight last night. Yesterday we didn't see a lot of federal police. Today, folks are reporting seeing more federal police around. And exactly what that looks like, it's I think we're gonna learn. It's been 13 hours. It's 1 o'clock on Friday here in DC. So I think it's going to get pretty tense over the week. The first communication I got about this was from Free DC with like tips on how to stay safe. In this moment, that also emphasized that like, hey, this is our home. And a way to engage in resistance in this moment is to not hide. And it's to go. Be visible, be out in the streets, go for a walk with your kids, have have some joy, because that is an act of resistance that we can have in this particular moment. I think it's going to get more acute as we understand exactly what those intervention the federal interventions start to look like.
Yeah, the one of the characteristics of rise in authoritarianism that from my understanding is incompetence, because they hire for loyalty, not competence. And we're also seeing like layoffs of, he just actually laid off a whole bunch of people out of the FBI who were part of the January 6th investigation, that sort of thing. So hopefully one thing we will see through all of this is, whatever they do, and if they do things like this, they'll do it poorly. I mean, definitely when I look at the ICE raids in Southern California in particular, is it seems like that it's very disorganized, and that the community resistance there is pretty fierce in disrupting their operations. And
They're
so I
rolling up to Home Depots in box trucks. This is Patriot Front shit. Like,
yeah
both
I'm sure there's
in
I'm sure they're
yeah.
recruiting out of Patriot Front too.
Yes. They're recruiting anybody, as we learned in South Park this week.
Yeah, that's true. So the last thing I wanted to touch on, well, there's one other thing around the incompetence and of the Trump administration is that there's, because we just said we wanted to talk about this, is there's also a level of disruption going on with Trump, at least within his narrative around the Epstein files. I'll just ask you this as a media consumer and as a resident of DC is, what are you seeing around that, if anything?
Yeah, so I think that it is the situation is tragic, and it is amusing to watch for as horrific as the experience that the survivors and victims went through. It seems like a really unforced error. I wasn't thinking about Epstein 6 weeks, six months ago. It was only that Pam Bondi said, "I have a file with the list," and then didn't said, "There's nothing here." Like, it's a complete unforced error. I think that there's so I think there's a couple things we should be concerned about. What one is, how this gets weaponized. The deputy attorney general went to Florida, interviewed Ghislaine Maxwell, who the only way she's going to walk out of prison, before she's 80, is if she gets a pardon from Trump. Nobody was asking people, the government to open an investigation. People were saying, share what you already found, share what it is you already found. So now they're going and getting this new information, and they're likely to. There's talk about releasing it, and I'm sure that one. I'm sure that people like Alan Dershowitz, Larry Summers, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, all very likely engaged in.
Prince Andrew.
Definitely, we've known that. Like, all are implicated in this. So yeah, that's going to come out, but like everybody knew that already. I think it, what I think that we are missing with the files, and in that is that there's likely something in those files that is, so we all know that these men did terrible things, and they're probably not going to face consequences for it. And even if the files are released, they're unlikely to face consequences. There's probably something about the sources and methods of how they collected that information and or other activity that that Epstein was involved in on behalf of some government or something, that has made it so both sides, both Democratic and Republican administrations have looked at it and they're like, oh, we can't release that. So it seemed like a forced error, but then, I am a little concerned at the way that the Trump administration is likely to kind of weaponize this next phase to deflect from themselves and move away from whatever is really, really in those documents.
The interesting thing I find about it is that it's actually just not going away, and I'm happy, which actually makes me feel there's some sense of relief I have in that it's not something they've been able to just let pass with the 24-second news cycle that we're on, and so I'm happy about that. It's also interesting how it's actually created some division in the MAGA base, at least initially. It seems like they've tried to sort of do something about that. But it's just not, it's not. And I think that's a great thing. So.
Yeah, I mean the one other, like I th this I'm gonna bring this back to something that I wanted to bring up earlier. I can imagine some version of this playing out during the Congress doesn't have to do a lot on an ongoing basis. They've gotta pass a budget or a continuing resolution to keep the government running. And We are going to hit another budget deadline on September 30th. And if we got a situation where there's a collision course between the administration and Congress, and Democrats are in a position to hold the line, then it could become really difficult for for Congress to figure out a way to fund the government. And we could see some type of shutdown opportunity around September 30th. And it is just this kind of like, it's not Congress's job to investigate creeps like Jeffrey Epstein, but it is just this kind of like debacle that they have created that could create the perfect storm where there's enough division that they can't actually get something done, and it could have a significant material impact in stalling the Trump operation.
Yeah, totally. This goes back to the thing I was saying about the incompetence, is that they're completely, one, he's completely corrupt and criminal, but then incompetent too, and brings incompetent people in to run his operations who just don't know what they're doing. And that includes with some of the leaders in Congress. Sadly, I would also say the Democratic leadership is also very bad at politics. And you know, like you're saying, this is another great opportunity for the Democratic leadership to lead, to do something to undermine this push, and you know, I give it more than 50-50 that they will flub it. So the last thing I want to say in the last couple of minutes that we have, the one last thing I want to ask you about around the resistance is that we're seeing this mass starvation campaign in Gaza. And, you know, resistant, there's been a lot of resistance around this. You and I were talking about this before the show. We've seen a lot of mass mobilization. We saw actually what I felt like is this pretty strategic action on the base of student university students last year. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are and what you're seeing on this front.
So I think that you can only have just big rallies so much. So over the past many months, we've really seen a pivot towards, I think, more strategic interventions, going after corporations like Raytheon and Palantir. We're seeing specific, more targeted action around specific members of Congress with more specific sets of demands, where the float, the kind of spate of flotillas that we've seen, Greta Thunberg hopped on a boat. Chris Smalls from the Amazon Workers Union was on a flotilla, and I think most interestingly, there's a family of hostages flotilla that is departing relatively
It's happening
soon.
now.
So I think that we saw a lot of a move towards kind of smaller, more kind of laser focused actions with the recent news that Netanyahu says is saying he's gonna permanently occupy Gaza City, and also this a lot of countries around the world changing their position on recognizing the state of Palestine. We may be pivoting towards a more mass mobilization, mass resistance, or mass disruption moment. Here in the US, I also think that we're likely to see much more dramatic resistance going on among the Israeli people, who really have no interest in continuing this war in this particular way.
You know, although I do find polls I see coming out of Israel very troubling, like 80% are unbothered by what's going on in Gaza, or more than 50% support the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. I am very troubled by that, but I do see a minority of Israeli Jews and probably Israeli Arabs who are like very much part of this resistance, where we see a lot of people in the streets. They go to, you know, Netanyahu's house and protest at his house. And you know, Israel also has a lot of authoritarian characteristics as well, so I think that's quite courageous. The other thing I want to ask about is, you know, is we're seeing these We're seeing U.S. action targeting contractors like Raytheon and the media. We also had a home demo near D.C. of the head of the Global Humanitarian Project, which I'm glad to see that that is a, in my opinion, and a very e that is an evil entity, not a very is a very evil entity. You know, it's luring people to food aid and then shooting them. And so I'm glad to see, and I'm glad to see that people connected to the Global Humanitarian Project are being targeted.
Absolutely. We're getting, whistleblowers with, I think that this is stuff that we've seen with, we've seen with our own eyes, we've seen images of, but now we're having people who are, directly involved coming in, in speaking out. I think that makes it a lot
Anthony
more real.
Aguilar is like on everything from Zatteo Media to Democracy Now to just did Tucker Carlson. It's also interesting to see Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene being part of the resistance. In many ways, I would actually say they're more fierce resistance to some of what's going on under the Trump regime than the Democrats. Some of the Democrats, anyway.
And that is something that we all actually need to figure out how to navigate, because there's this, I think if we are going to build the type of resistance that we need, create the type of disruption that we need, we're going to need people in action who are people that we don't necessarily that we disagree with about a lot of things. There's a big difference between having people be in action and kind of understanding their strategic actions along in the context of ours and being in our movements, right? We don't need to, open our arms and welcome Tucker Carlson into our movements, but we can understand that some of what he is doing right now is moving groups of people that we don't necessarily we don't want to talk to, our challenge is a bit, how do we not put on blinders and ignore the fact that it's happening? It's important to understand the full landscape, while also maintaining our political and our integrity, because these are people who say and do things that hurt our communities a lot.
Yeah, and I want to say is one of the things that we've also seen historically of resistance movements against authoritarianism is that in the authoritarian foundation there are wedges, there are cracks, and there are wedges. And so what Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene and others on in MAGA world, particularly in the MAGA podcast world, as we're seeing it a lot, but also, some political figures and other figures, is that these wedges are really important. And this is where we're starting to see it. I mean, whatever, Trump is also at 35% or 37% popularity with the country, but these wedges in his base are actually very critical to how we win and hopefully avert an a complete authoritarian takeover.
Absolutely.
I'm going to wrap it there.
Great,
Patrick,
great.
it's been fun talking with you. Folks, we've been talking with Patrick Young in Washington, D.C., organizer and good troublemaker. You're listening to the Green and Red podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter and Blue Sky. And if you're watching us on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. It helps with the algorithm. And if you really like us, go to Green and Red Podcast. .org and hit the support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast.
If
And
you are a Patreon contributor long enough, Scott will invite you on the show.
you
That's
will
how I
become a
got
recurring
here.
guest. You'll be a recurring guest. Yeah. Because Patrick is both a guest and a comrade and a patron of the Green and Red Podcast. Everybody make trouble and misbehave, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Right, thanks.